There was first a feeling that we very lightly skimmed over two this morning. One was the Sakya Bhava, friendship, the attitude of friendship, and the attitude of lover. I think we must remember in this discussion that it is, the whole thing is based on two important principles. One, that particular aspect of love exists on the human level, and two, that it is a sublimation. When we don't even know what the real friendship means, how am I going to sublimate that friendship into? There must first be the real experience on the human level, and then that must be sublimated to the divine level. That is, there is an element of earthiness in the human relationship. If I am your friend, I at least expect you to do something. I want you to do something. In simple words, I exploit that friendship. We all do that, yes? Except in the case of genuine master-servant relationship, even that is nearly going. I have seen it to the edification of some of the poorer classes of people in the world. I have seen it among the very poor people. Still, it exists. In the rural areas, among very poor people. You heard them in Africa, yes? South Africa. About that. Even some Africans, black people, in their devotion to the white master, they are total devotion. It's a beautiful thing to watch. It's something which, you know, from all the, one wouldn't expect so easily. It is there. I know of some people who would do anything to serve the master. And in the same way, I've seen it in the case of some very poor people in India. Not because they are poor, not because they are afraid to lose the job, but somehow they develop that feeling. Their heart seems to be so unpolluted by all these ideas of exploitation, how to exploit a situation that they have never thought about. So the heart is still pure. We have seen that. And the other relationship between the parent and the infant, that's also there. That's something somehow built into the life stream itself. Whereas when it comes to treating God as a friend, there is this risk of overstepping one's bounds, and instead of sublimating it, reducing even the divine to the level of a caricature. That risk is there. In the same way, there is the same risk in the lover-beloved relationship. I suppose again, in India, this has gone almost one complete circle. And I believe under this umbrella, all sorts of atrocious malpractices are going on. And then everybody turned against it. Not against the misuse of this principle, but against the whole thing itself. People saying, I am Krishna and you are a gopi, you know, dance, let's dance. That's all right. He is Krishna, you are gopi. If you can regard him as Krishna and regard yourself as gopi, it's all right. But then suddenly something else happens. The Krishna gopi is forgotten. So one has to be extremely cautious in this. It's based on this principle that we understand this love is evident and it is on the level of our daily experience. I experience this. I know what it is. I have a sample of it here. And then that must be extended to cover everything. So that what began as a small ripple might become an ocean. If that is not there, then the whole thing becomes vicious, undesirable. And again, there is, as we have been discussing this, division and devotion. First, there is division and devotion and integration. This whole approach again has to follow the same pattern, that there must be a division in the beginning, that I love my infant, my baby, my child, and I love you. I love God as my child. First step is I love my child. I know what that love is. The second step is I love God as my child, and I love God in all children. Not X or Y or Z, not these people. I love God in all these children, so that you don't fall into the trap again. How to avoid the trap and live in this world without being trapped? So there is this division and devotion together. Since that is a bit tricky in the case of the friend relationship, treating God as your friend, we just skipped over it. As a matter of fact, it is explicitly stated so in the second story, which I forgot the details, so I didn't deal with it in the morning. A very recent saint in South India also treated Shiva as his friend. And so, call him. Go and tell that girl I love her. See that I get married to her. Etc. etc. God had to go and Shiva had to go and appear in her dream, appear in the dream of the father, appear in etc. all this, and then bring about the marriage. Then he fell in love with somebody else. Now what about this? etc. And it becomes more and more complicated. More and more complicated. Sort of abuse of this relationship. Is it possible again, with the help of this, to stop our abuse at the human level? Possible, yes. You are my friend. And can I, at the same time, sublimate this relationship and see and love the God in you? You are my friend. God is the friend in you. So I love the God in you as a friend. Then it is also possible to sublimate this human relationship and raise it up instead of bringing the other thing down. So I don't get disappointed. That, if you remember, those of you who were here last week, if you remember, this also was the basic principle in Karma Yoga, yes? That I serve not Mr. X or Mrs. Y, but the divine principle, divine spark in all. And therefore, the cultivation of this attitude or feeling or bhavana helps us regulate our life here and attitude towards people, relationship. Two things are important. One is that it should stop us from exploiting one another, exploiting any relationship. And number two, it shouldn't degenerate. It should be uplifting and not degenerating. Is there a, who is the expert in Christian theology here? Is there a belief or whatever it is that all the nuns at least are married to Jesus?
Yes, it's a ceremony
of the church.
It's a ceremony when they become nuns. They take a ring, just like St. Catherine.
Right.
And a veil.
Ah, you see, it's a bridal veil, is it?
Mm-hmm. They wear a wedding dress. They wear a wedding dress.
Just a veil.
Oh, well, some do.
Yeah?
Yeah, some wear a whole wedding dress, and then they take it off and put on the habit afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
The question I asked there, is it to Jesus or to the church?
No, Jesus.
No, the church itself is regarded as the bride of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
The whole body of church itself is regarded as the bride of Christ, I think, yes? Mm-hmm. That I have heard. But this I am not quite sure about. Because there is a legend that Krishna had 16,108 wives. I often felt that is probably the same as Christ and all the nuns being the brides of Christ. Probably at that time there were 16,108 nuns.
In other words, this would still be another point where the two tie together, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have often felt that what you call Christ is what the others call Krishna. Both these are one person.
Swamiji, I'm a little confused. Krishna was actually an incarnated avatar like Christ?
Mm-hmm. No. I'm suggesting that there was one incarnation, and that one incarnation was somehow viewed as two different people. Even the names are very much alike, Christ, mm-hmm. Krishna. And the story is very much alike. That they were born in some obscure place. I don't know if I sound a bit heretical here, both to the Christian and the Hindu. If say some of us, maybe those of you who were born in pre-war Europe, you may not even remember in which house exactly, in what street, and unless your parents are alive. Where you were born, it's all gone, it's probably bombed out. Huh? It's only afterwards, when Jesus became the Christ, when he came into his full glory, it's only afterwards it's probably possibly somebody thought of, hey, what happened to this boy? Where was he born? Lovely, wonderful chap. It's possible the same thing happened to Krishna. We have been trying, battling with it. That's why I know this problem intimately. Yeah. Nobody wrote a biography of Swami Shivananda when he was a doctor in Malaya. Nobody thought of all this. When he was about 50, he became a well-known Swami and saint, etc., etc. It is only then we started looking for his horoscope. birth chart. And one didn't exist. And then you conduct some research. What is the research? How to go? I try to do a bit of it. No one knew where. He himself was fairly reticent about all that. And where did he live in Malaya? Where did he work in Malaya? Suddenly you become a saint today, and we had a worry about your biography. You've forgotten 3/4 of what happened to you in your early childhood, boyhood, girlhood. So it's possible that someone vaguely remembered, and the story of Christ was not recorded, committed to writing, till about 3 or 4 centuries after he passed away. And then, out of all these bits and pieces of hearsay, rumors floating around, you compile a biography. The same thing might have happened in the case of Krishna, or the two are one.
Swamiji, there is a manuscript that was found in Egypt that dates from 60 AD. It's, can't remember the name of it now.
Right, Thomas. It's still a manuscript.
Huh? Thomas' Gospel.
St. Thomas' Gospel. Mm.
Yeah. They estimated it around 60.
Yeah, but is it accepted as canon? No.
No.
That's it. That's another problem.
The accepted canon isn't until, I think it was 325.
Right. It's all hearsay and something pieced together. I'm not saying this to discredit anything, either Krishna or Christ. So, one merely remembers that he was of very humble birth. If you forget the manger, if you forget the prison cell, you merely realize this as a fact that he was. I may say they were, but in your own mind, please translate it as he was. Of a humble birth. And then as, what do we remember of this person's early life? Oh, he was very devoted. Isn't that how we build up our biographies? Oh, he was a very devoted chap. And that is given in the lives of Krishna and Christ. But also, he was a radical. Oh, he used to go about chasing people and that sort of thing. And that's stated in the life of Krishna and Christ, that he sort of revolutionized the existing
social
tradition. No, religious tradition.
There are stories then that Krishna did the same sort of thing like Christ with moneylenders.
Yes. Not moneylenders. That's it. It's a revolutionary, radical attitude. And it is said that Krishna stopped some kind of worship. They used to do some kind of funny worship, which is wasting money, wasting this, wasting all that. And he said, why do you do all this? Stop this worship. Stop this meaningless worship. Introduce a meaning to it. And then there is a something Jesus is supposed to have said, that if you have the faith of a mustard seed and you say the mountain go, it will go. It's possible that this was sort of floating around, and someone demonstrated it, painted a picture. If you have the faith of the mustard seed, say go, it will go. And you raise a finger. And so you put a mountain on top of the finger. Then one sees the picture, and they might have evolved a story that Krishna lifted a mountain with his finger. Right? These look far-fetched now because we have very rigidly structured biography of Krishna and another biography called the biography of Christ. Maybe they are all one.
Swamiji, go ahead.
What about Buddha?
Buddha is, the story itself is very different and...
I meant as far as being the same incarnation.
Yeah. In the case of Buddha, they first rejected the whole thing because he was considered a heretic in his time, like a Protestant. Why was he considered a heretic? Because he didn't accept the authority of orthodoxy, like very much like Jesus. And then they found that the teaching was interesting, and it had an element of truth, a great element of truth in it. Then they found it was appealing, like radical teachings here, it appeals to people. Then, like all the young people in North America, they're all after this new cult. And they said, my God, I mean, if we are going to hang on to our traditional belief, and if we are going to say that this is heresy, the teaching of the devil may have more followers than we. And so they went back to their scriptures and reread the whole thing and said, oh, after all, what did Buddha teach? What Buddha taught is already there in our scriptures. A little while later, they said, oh, no. Krishna had already promised that this would happen, that he would come again. He himself has come as Buddha, right? Entry through the back door. My great-grandfathers, they were not very well read, and so they didn't understand Buddha's teaching. Now, we are enlightened, we know exactly what it is. That's it. And very, very soon, Buddha became another incarnation of Vishnu.
Swamiji, if Christ and Krishna would be the same person, isn't there a time gap between supposedly when they
live? Yeah, you remember one of these days we were discussing this geological time?
Mm-hmm.
How old is that rock? Maybe 30,000, maybe 40,000. Between 30 and 40,000, there's just a difference of one. The rest being zeros. One year's difference, isn't it? So how do we know all this? We don't even accept all the stories that have come down to us as authentic of Christ or Krishna. Some we call legend, some we call imaginary, some we call hallucination. And what is the difference between 2000 and 5000? Three years. If you ask a very knowledgeable Christian scholar, he says Christ was born 2000 years ago. And you ask someone else, when did Krishna live? 5000 years ago. What's the difference? Three years. It's just a human error. One must see, when one studies all this, do I start from a prejudice? And is that prejudice looking for
mm-hmm.
proofs? You will always find it. For instance, I am prejudiced in favor of the theory that the two are one person. I'll find my proofs.
Talk about the use of the mala.
Use of the mala, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Why do we use it, first of all? Doesn't have to be used. Doesn't have to be used. But if it, why do we use it? In order that it may trigger off the mental interpretation of the mantra. This is used purely as a trigger. And then, of course, you go on rolling, you attribute some power to this. It's also possible that such power exists. This is the famous relic theory. If you, Christ or Krishna or Buddha go on using something, and that relic acquires some of their divine power. So you have a hair from the head of Prophet Muhammad somewhere in Kashmir, the tooth of Buddha in Kandy, very zealously guarded. Some ashes of Mahatma Gandhi in Los Angeles. That sort of thing. So, that is something which is worth avoiding. Mala is a mala, use it. And if it breaks, or one can get very strongly hung up on that kind of thing. You are wearing it, and suddenly it breaks. Why did the mala break? Maybe some some trouble. Maybe I'm going to get into some trouble, maybe some misfortune is coming, maybe the Satan is attacking me. It's better to avoid all that. There's nothing, no such trouble, nothing at all. If mala breaks, throw it away, I'll give you another. People are like that. Sure. It's purely a trigger mechanism. When I take the mala in my hand and the hand is, the fingers are rolling the beads, and that means the nervous impulse is communicated to the brain, and the brain repeats the mantra. Right. Tell me what else you want. I'll the rules. The rules. How does one use the mala? You are not supposed to use the index finger. Why is it so? The index finger being this the symbol of the ego. We'll come back to the chin mudra a little later, after this, if I forget, remind me. This being the symbol of the ego, and also, you know, I'll hit you. You don't say, I'll hit you. it's always this. And what did you do? You don't say, what did you do? What is this? The accusing finger, the threatening finger, the accusing finger and the threatening finger, and the finger that is symbolic of vanity and ego is the index finger. And so symbolically we avoid using it to suggest that the ego doesn't participate in anything spiritual. Right. Another rule is that the bottom shouldn't come below the navel. So you must hold the mala like this up. This doesn't hang like this. I'll show, I didn't bring it now. I will, if you remind me tomorrow, I'll bring it and show you. I got one. One of those pouches.